And now from WCOM Radio 103.5 FM in beautiful downtown Carrboro, the historic Carolina Theater brings you the incomparable Claudio of Claudio's Speakeasy and Radio Theater.
Good morning, everyone. This is Halloween. This is a Halloween radio show for anyone out there listening. We've decided to do a bit of a tribute to Orson Welles, although we're not doing War of the Worlds, we're doing other wars. The opening performance today is given by our very own Ira David Wood III, who will soon be opening his show at DPAC in Durham, that being A Christmas Carol. And the opening piece is entitled The Mercenary Tide, and then he'll follow that up with a piece entitled The Confession of Mr. Clatton. The first one was inspired by The Devil's Triangle, and going through it, which I actually did several times, and The Confession of Mr. Clatton is a dark fear put to pen, the fear of accomplishing very little with your life, of doing nothing and then being condemned for something you didn't do. We give you Ira David Wood, The Mercenary Tide.
The ship has sailed from sea to shore, though it will take me home no more. But I shall leave her deck at sea and soon become a memory. The tale I have to tell is long and concerns the devil's daughters. I pray my words will be as strong as these tormenting waters. The clouds hung low in dreary skies as we sailed the wicked waves, and mine must have met the devil's eyes as we crossed these watery graves. The ship was tossed from side to side, the crew lay weak and ill, and soon this mercenary tide prepared us for the kill. The crewmen left me one by one, the mast hung loose and broken, and then there rose a midday sun. It was the devil's token. The waters reached a steady calm, and clouds all disappeared. I felt a finger touch my palm, to say the least, I feared. I soon beheld a lovely lady standing by my side. Her eyes appeared a trifle shady, said I, woe betide. And then I soon beheld two more entangled in my view. Stood I more baffled than before, for what was I to do? And then they spoke, each one in turn, in words for which I will not yearn. The ruler has a place for you beneath these hostile waters, and bids that you will be so true as to follow us, his daughters. He says your cruel and wicked ways have brought you to this favor, and that in the ending of your days you need no longer labor. He has for you a mansion built so far beneath the sea, where in the ending of your days you will dwell eternally. It was as I heard the ending word, I fell to my knees and prayed, and the devil daughters strayed. I've asked the forgiveness, and I pray he has heard, for I could not bear the ending word. Though it's been so many days now that I've been lost at sea, and none other than the devil bade his return to me. Alas, my prayers have been in vain, for God has chosen to refrain. With weakened eyes I stared at the sky, for the moment has come that I must die. And it is not for the friends I shall see in hell, but for the other few that I bid farewell. No, it was definitely not without motive. Neither with inhumane intentions that I abducted young Susan Erasmus. It is therefore that I ask whether I can rightfully be put to blame for what eventually occurred. Since the passing of my wife, Eva, I had lost all hope. I began blaming myself for not having showered her with riches and cherished her with a good home, honor, and love. But alas, I was born a man of poverty and without ambition. Unlike many of my short acquaintances, I was also completely untalented. Home? Oh, we did have a shack with a bedroom and bathroom up in the hills, and I dare say we were extremely fortunate not to have it demolished by the wind. Its wood had aged extensively and was plagued with the stench of decay. Furniture? Oh, yes, we had furniture. Several chairs, a table, an old couch and bed which I had managed to deprive old Jensen, the junkyard dealer, of. All was worthless and reeked of age. The only thing of value in our possession was perhaps the wedding ring which I had given her, the one for which I had dug up the grave of a rich man's wife and cut off the woman's finger when the ring resisted me in my vigorous attempts at removing it. Once in my possession, I had the engraved initials changed. I recall she gave a look of disbelief when I placed it on her finger. The wedding ceremony, I dare say, went much to our satisfaction, although when I think of it now, it was all a lie that had put me to shame ever since. After the marriage, I was to find myself subjected to unending questions concerning that ring. Although I never told her and she never confronted me with a thought, I feel she knew it was acquired in a manner of dishonesty. Although I feel certain she had no idea it was done in disrespect to the dead. Had she known, it would most certainly have been reason for divorce. It was after 7 years of marriage that Eva was taken from me by a fatal attack of pneumonia, which brings me back to where I first began. Mr. Schmidt, her father, had gained his respect from the people in the village through his country cafe, which I was employed to guard come the night. It seemed no matter how well I performed my duty to him, I was never quite able to impress the man. In essence, what eventually occurred led me to believe my employment with him was due to an agreement he held with his daughter. I was released the week following her death. Poverty, despair, and darkness overwhelmed me in my solitude. For several weeks I secluded myself in the old shack contemplating suicide. I had even as much as attached a hangman's noose to the crossing wood beam supporting my roof. It was in the late of one Sunday afternoon that I finally reached my decision. I had decided to fight the darkness and my shame by beginning a new and respectable life elsewhere, in another town, another place, where I would be a complete stranger. Yes, such were my intentions. Optimistic illusions. It suddenly occurred to me that my present finances would not support the execution of my decision. For a brief moment I stared at the rope suspended from my ceiling, though completely oblivious of its presence, for my thoughts were of financial concern. And then of a sudden I remembered. I had yet failed to receive my final payment from Schmidt, the payment due me ere my seclusion within the world of my own tortuous pessimism. I therefore made it the first step of my new direction by venturing forth to settle the matter with old Schmidt. It was a 3-mile walk from my shack to the cafe, which I had so often dreaded deeply, though strangely not upon this day. Perhaps the reason for it was that for the first time in my 40 years of life, I had indeed set a goal for myself, one which unto this moment I had no doubts of reaching, neither had I the intention of committing myself into anything leading from it. As I arrived by the café, I observed an elderly couple with their young daughter sitting by a table in the center of the dining area. It was the same table upon which Eva and I occasionally chose to have our meals, mostly, though, I dare say, upon invitation by her father. Her father, who thought in debt to me, nonetheless, and I have no doubts, wished me dead. There passed the rumor that he had put me to blame for the death of my wife, though I dare say it came as no surprise that he would think of me in such terms, for it is, as I have told, that he had no respect within him for me, or any of my doing. When I think of it now, the thought of him wishing me dead was perhaps the more peaceful of his own thoughts for my fate. The pungent aroma of pipe tobacco teased my nostrils as I approached the rear of the café. I saw Schmidt leaning back on his favorite rocking chair, in a rather contemplative composure, enjoying his pipe. Before I was able to break the silence by introducing my presence, he was approached by one of his waiters. The waiter mumbled something to the effect that Mr. Erasmus wished to discuss a proposition with him. He arose and turned, looking directly at me, then entered the café in complete and deliberate disregard of my presence. I refused to allow myself to be overcome by the feeling of insult, and therefore decided to await his return. I was even to take the liberty of comforting myself in his chair. And so I did. Ere the passing of an hour, as I comfortably anticipated his return, the young girl whom I had first seen in dining with the elderly couple, apparently, or as it would seem, her parents, came running outside, displaying her youthful energy and making it most obvious that she had been permitted to play. When at last she saw me sitting there, she looked over as if inviting me to participate and share with her the joyous feeling of her own freedom. Convincing me to do so was no task, for my love for the young was indeed overwhelming. Eventually, as she tired of play, she began relating through her own verbal intelligence more and more of the extremely wealthy background, and included in her manner that her father was presently proposing to purchase the café from old Schmidt. She had no knowledge of his financial proposal, though it was clear to see Schmidt would not sell cheaply. I must confess that with the continuance of her family revelations, a most hideous thought implanted itself within my brain and grew like a phosphorus bubble about to burst into a luminescent spray. I placed the ransom note with details for the return of Mr. Erasmus's daughter upon the rocking chair. Susan required little convincing, as I proposed it to be merely a game of hide-and-seek, and she followed me through the forest to the rear of the café. As we took the long way around, we were soon invisibly bound for the old shack. In the ransom note, I had made mention of Erasmus's black horse and carriage, and that he was to appear with it alone, and with my demanded sum of 10,000 francs. I also included all that could be settled peacefully, and that informing the police would only lessen the chance of her safe return. Abduction, kidnapping, call it what you will. No doubt you now regard me as one unworthy of even the last breath, a victim of insanity, social hazard, a bastard worthy of nothing less than having my pupils slit through the razor's edge. No, no! It is not apparent to you that I had intended the girl no harm. I had even related the reason as to why I so desperately needed the money. That was not all. No, no. Now hear me well. I had even gone so far as to offer him the return of his money once having gained the desired employment. You failed to recognize and understand my only desire and motive was to create the chance to begin anew.
wherever and at long last. Live, 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 to live was my desire, not to harm. And the money, I felt certain it would not as much as put a dent in his account. He would merely have to postpone the purchasing of the cafe. We soon arrived by the old shack, and I bade her inside to hide with me. She had not the slightest suspicion of having been abducted, for I beheld a very clever attitude toward her. I had the perfect answer to her every question, and thereby comforted her to stay. I recollect when she first entered the shack, it appalled her to the very marrow of her bones. Though once explained that it was to be only a temporary hideaway, she became more content with her dispirited surroundings. The ones that had for so many tormenting years been to Eva and I what I had given us no choice other than to call home. I shuddered at the very thought. The child in young Susan permitted her curiosity to guide her through several of my belongings as I patiently anticipated the arrival of the black horse and carriage through a crevice between the wood. It was less than 2 hours before I eventually discerned what appeared to be the top of Erasmus's carriage as his horse drew it stealthily up the hill and into my full view. Mr. Erasmus himself sat behind the reins, and it appeared he was alone. I watched with a critical eye as the carriage came to a halt, and he appeared before it, more a silhouette in the dim light of the dusk of evening. Once assured and confident that he had indeed taken it upon himself to come alone, I opened my door and turned to face young Susan. It was at that moment my heart fell to the mercy of a thunderous beat. I observed the horrible, in shock and with paralyzed eyes. The chair which I had left standing beneath the rope intended for my suicide fell, and one strangled scream emanated from her young lips. With it came the loudest silence I had yet experienced within myself. Her father, as he heard the scream, came bursting through my door, heaving me face first upon the splintered floor. Immediately he freed her from the rope, and her dancing dead in midair while I fumbled about to regain myself. I knew before he so angrily thrust himself upon me that Susan was dead, for the rope that now dangled in this enraged, hate-enshrouded and blood-stained atmosphere was indeed secured in such a fashion that my own weight would not as much as have budged its grip around the wood, and the noose as death ensured as in the tradition of the executioner. Now I am here, born from yesterday into the today that is tomorrow's hell. Alas, I feel I need confess no more, for I, the hunter and victim of my inner self, have despite all been crippled with this final burden. The judgment is made. I am crucified to my conviction, and the penalty shall be dealt me ere the full rising of the morning sun. So it is. And so, before I bring to conclusion these vain frustrations, and therewith this dismal existence, I must bring clarity upon these my bleeding words. Their purpose you have doubtfully comprehended, for they were intended neither for mercy nor any in such accordance, sympathizing emotions. No, I merely sought an audience for my theatre of words. Though this theatre is become that of my condemnation, where the room and chairs are filled with an aura of the living dead, and justice sits glorified upon his throne of skeletons, and bitter tongues spit the convictions, I rejoice that the cloak of death shall embrace me here. Never before have I been so prepared and willing. Yes, death is indeed the gift for which I have lived and yearned, for in all of my days I have achieved no less than making the perfect enemy of my inner self. Yes, alas. In this life, death shall come as the welcome visitor, but it shall be the ecstasy. The sun shall rise to a newborn day as the guillotine will fall and decapitate my uselessness. I will be relieved of all ulcerous emotions that were the foundation of my life and days. Ah, I see it there, beyond that distant hill, one glimpse between the roofs and the steel-cast rods of my cage. A voice in the corridor.
The barking of dogs. Life as it challenges the morn. And there again. Yes, I see it now. Far more clearly. The rising of the morning sun.
And that was Ira David Wood with The Mercenary Tide and The Confession of Mr. Clatton. I'd like to introduce everyone else that I have here in the studio. I have Mr. Bob Crowley, the current author of The Wanderer of New Hope.
Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. And he'll be performing a piece a little later on himself. I've got my co-host, Audrey Layden, who is at this point a guest and artist in the studio. Welcome, Audrey.
A new role. This is fun.
She's going to be a witch. I have the renowned Alan R. Hall, theatre critic and reviewer, formerly for the Chapel Hill News and now more independently. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning.
And of course we have Blake Tedder on sound effects and all other measures for the day. And I am yours truly, Claudio. The stories that everyone is performing are stories I myself have written over the years, and I will continue to introduce each one and perhaps read one of my own toward the end if there's time. Again, that was Ira David Wood, you just heard from. And he will be opening up a Christmas carol at DPAC and other locations coming up soon. Just check their website. Coming up next, my good friend, Alan R. Hall, will be performing Saltwater and Adrenaline, as well as Nautical Fatigue. And we'll have Blake Tedder on sound effects. This is Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre. WCOM 103.5 FM. We're actually going to hear some effects before we go on with Alan.
That bastard son of a priestly affair more than had it coming when he affronted the old mariner. No one witnessing the entire shuffle between the two saw it coming. Least of all did the offender. A sailor who stood to the right of the old man, a young American tourist to the left of the other, and I at the far end of the bar were all drawn to observe the situation. We were noticeably affected in doing so by the sheer tense nature of their pantomime and gestures. Anyhow, it was obvious to all of us that the younger brute, a mate from the schooner Alexander who was commonly aroused by drink, began the confrontation verbally and was the entire fault of it. On several occasions the old man gestured him away, but his attitude only became more aggressive and confrontational. This continued for what seemed a lengthy period of offense and defense which gradually appeared to take on a certain gloom heretofore unnoticed. It certainly made the occasion for a drink more interesting to all except the bartender, who, by the distraction of his duties in preparation for a busy evening in port, was and remained oblivious to the psychological metamorphosis at mid-bar. The situation very abruptly began to lose any element of tolerance by its onlookers, and I, having placed my drink upon the bar, was already in motion to bring it to a halt. I had seen enough. The next few seconds held us all at bay and with bated breath. In mid-gesture of the brute offender, the gnarly-fingered old sea-dog leapt from his stool with singular aim and absolute ambition and wrapped his narrow, long fingers about the neck of this aggressive fool, who was totally dumbstruck and ill-prepared against the sheer momentum of it. Both fell with a heaving crash upon the floor, and thus even the bartender sprang to alarm. The struggle continued horizontally and appeared rather conclusively, that of the offender gasping for breath and trying to rid himself of the mariner's claustrophobic grip about his neck, yet to no avail. The old man had very successfully calculated the rhythm of exhalation by the undesired solicitor of his wrath. He had thereupon, in unanticipated momentum, clasped the fool in a death grip from which only an outside support and physical effort could free him. As I momentously regained my advancement in their direction, more due to the lunatic ravings of an unseasoned bartender than my own response to the sudden turn of events, I was to find myself once more surprised. Many minutes had ensued since the impact was delivered, and many a claustrophobic moment hence had yielded the offender no relief in the nature of his struggle. As I arrived to separate the two, I was to witness the younger man slipping rapidly into unconsciousness while the elder maintained his gruesome grip. Several of us realized that unless the strangulation hold was arrested immediately, it would bear fatal results. I thus dedicated myself wholly to the effort. It was only with my truest effort, physical force, was I able to unlock the mariner's fingers from about the young fool's neck, and in so doing, discovered the old man dead.
And one more time for Alan R. Hall. This time it's a piece written that was very much inspired by both legend, myth, and piracy. We give you Alan R. Hall in Nautical Fatigue.
He stood the son of a weary sailor, a captain at the helm, fatigued by the scars of turbulent voyage, in a very unearthly realm. The night was as still as a lethal silence summoning its prey as they weighed in the anchor and loosed their moorings there at Sea Dog's Quay. The journey that was to ensue bore hardships in its wake, and nary a seaman held e'er a clue aboard the captain's take. Ere I proceed from tedium to terror in these chronicles of maritime woes, I must reveal why I chose the appeal and to navigate in poetry and prose. From the rhyming in the rigging came the ballads of the bold, and the verse begat the shanty as the waters round them rolled. Now from many bouts of drinking rhyme to melody would spring, and the humor of an age is oft contained in what we sing. Mother Ocean has a motion that is measured to and fro, and a depth beyond leagues and fathoms to where only poets go. To make of metaphor a language, there can be no nobler choice than certain words evoked by rhythm, given heartbeat and a voice. With sails full set and a cargo delivered, she slashed like a whetted knife through the bay, 13 knots windward wheeling, captain impassioned and steering from the strange and unearthly stay. He had sailed through the summers and winters of a highly successful career, though oft in abandon he would say quite at random, "What the hell am I still doing here?" He had sensed gloom and foreboding in this lengthy run, and felt like a prey in the sights of a gun. On this eve of All Hallows, while outskirting the shadows, with the first mate and crew settled in, a forlorn gull gave its night's cry, while the moon, like a dead eye, mocked at all that was soon to begin. Was the loss of wind and power product of omen or hour, as the clock in the wheelhouse showed a minute past 3? He was lured by strange motions, neither the ships nor the oceans, as he took hold of a rifle his concerns to free. It was wholly the fault of a tragic assault when the captain's face bloodied the deck. In a drunken sway and swagger, his foe stooped to pull a dagger and stabbed it harsh between his shoulder bone and neck. The crew was as such deserted, having never been alerted to the butchery already on the make, for they were boarded by dark terrors, consuming souls and blood and errors, leaving only tides of crimson on the captain's take. Ere they disembarked the schooner, a strange ritual commenced, as they gathered in a circle 13 wide. Of these pirates, 3 were wenches, 2 a youngster and a boy, the others men of middle ages, demon-eyed. As they linked in eerie gestures of a satanic consent, giving thanks for their bloodletting and all murderous intent, there befell a strange momentum to their union on the bow, with the galley cook appearing from below. As rage ensued with apprehension, yielding yet another dark dimension to some ancient and macabre demonic vow. Moonshadow bore outline of a coastline ahead, while sea breezes whispered a prayer for the dead. The schooner had been drifting since the massacre ensued, with a galleon at the starboard, black flags beckoning the feud. "Ye've meted out insanity unmercilessly grand, and now the blood of 22 lies thick upon your hands," spoke the cook, and placed a cauldron with hiss and sizzle upon the deck, whilst his anger drew a spirit which sought only ruin and wreck. They stood dumbfounded and transfixed, as if by some gothic spell, when suddenly they ran amok, like gruesome hounds of hell. Then aiming with a seasoned eye, he ladle-dipped his liquid fry, and nary a soul was left to tell of the rage that burned in him so well. Perhaps he was somehow possessed of a view both stark and narrow, though he wielded well his dark duress and reduced them to their marrow. For there in wretched contortions lay a testament to devil's prey. Sentiment, bloodlust, and gore herein give whirl to metaphor. Suspense by nature of intrigue is best delivered without fatigue. To conjure mood mindful of place yields character with stronger face, color with essence and speckle with hue, to navigate your realm more true. Amidst the bloody ruin and carnage, the cook heard a painful groan as he saw the wounded captain struggle to regain his own. He made swift of his assistance as he slid across the deck, where he saw a strange protrusion issuing from the captain's neck. "Rest with God, me weary captain, 'tis mere miracle you're alive, though perhaps 'tis dark a humor we were chosen to survive. You're a brave man and a hero," said he, gurgling blood and spit, as the knife twixt necks and shoulder made a spectacle of it. "It seems the blade has blocked your arteries, at least significantly so, as not to have your life flow from you, or have your senses go." The captain crouched with sway and stagger, arching for the wheelhouse door, whilst the cook, with abandon, helped retrieve him from the floor. Once positioned at the ship's wheel, upon which he much relied, he brought her about to the horizon, which the moon had not belied. He gave some thought to wary regions of the devil and his legions, for there are lessons in the turning of the tide. When forlorn gull gives out its night's cry, and the moon mocks like a dead eye, then be forewarned of lethal darknesses astride. So there he stood in anchored silence, all his depths now moored and thrust, salvaged by a sharp enigma that would some day turn to rust. Both men remained in weary gesture, summoned of a dark intrigue, while their souls sought resurrection from a nautical fatigue.
And that was Nautical Fatigue by Alan R. Hall. Before that, he had Salt Water and Adrenaline. Things that can happen in a pub. And then things that can happen at sea. Or in darkness. Coming up next, we have WCOM's very own Audrey Layden performing None Too Soon. I give you Audrey Layden.
Thank you, Claudio, for telling my tale and putting it to paper. None Too Soon, the legacy of a witch. Witches, witches burning bright in the pyres of the night, and what mockery of light they shed upon these murders by the living dead. Churches, churches in their wake empty us out our souls to take, and all political discipleships endeavor to join us at the hips. Eye of hypocrite and tongue of snake are among the procurements that I make. For a wicked brew called None Too Soon to be consumed during the harvest moon. It will twist your psyche into altered states with every demon at the gates whose sole ambition is to incite such mercenaries in their plight. And I, of specter, wraith, and sands, hold ancient longings in my hands, and will as such condemn to rot, you legions of a vacant lot. May nature's fury rise like steam and sever the unguided dream to conquer mortals steeped in greed and yield the winds their evil seed. And when the chaff frees from the grain, and reckonings consume all blame, then, once again, may fair winds blow across a deadening undertow. All the while, let sense prevail that nature is our holy grail, and living things of every kind deserve but nurturings to find. And should you learn these lessons not, and greed again begin to rot, where any sense of self should state, beware the demons at the gate. Know in your heart and by your soul, this witch will have you pay the toll by every utterance and speak, and every light your soul shall seek. For I have long been cast by fate as evil among those you rate. Though I am from the devil not, tradition is your vacant lot, and church and politic your shame. In the futile regions of your blame, where, on this night of Halloween, all darkness is revealed and seen. Remember me, though I am cloaked with every misery you've stoked, when underneath a harvest moon your judgment cometh, none too soon.
And that was Audrey Layden, the one and only, our very own witch aboard. This is your captain speaking, by the way. Coming up next, we're going to have our very current author, although he's authored other things in the past, the author of The Wanderer of New Hope, Bob Crowley himself, giving us something that I feel reflects the true horror of our current society, our current politic, our current just everything about our current situation. I thought in all these renderings we needed to also render something absolutely relevant. Here's Bob Crowley to give you Ravages Unseen.
Ravages Unseen. It is a truth in the heart of every soldier that nobody really wins in war. The losses which are most extreme are those within that brace the dream, that in the darkness of war's plight strike dim our sanctuary of light, where ravages endured unseen struggle to reach for some esteem. It is the weary soldier's lot our sin of strife to bear. Their courage may not be forgot, lest we drink deep of their despair. So welcome from the battlefields of yesterday's remorse, we gratefully extend our hearts and bid your souls upon their course. For any warmth we may exude, come to us as a friend. Together we may conquer all that wars bring to no end.
Thank you, Bob. I think that's a very relevant statement for our current day and time. And in the passion of the moment, we must always remember that politicians are like diapers. They need changing often, and for the same reason. Coming up next, I'd like to give you a story I wrote some time ago about Africa, where I was raised. I won't give too much of the story away. I think we're going to have Blake doing some beautiful sound accompaniments, but I do want to mention ahead of time that I'm going to be using some Afrikaans terms, so I thought I'd give the translation to them now. As you listen, you will hear me use the term knopkiri, which is an African hand-carved wooden staff. Also kraal, which is a native village, surrounded by a steep clay wall for purposes of defining the tribal dwelling, as well as a protectorate from wildlife and other tribal attacks. Voortrekkers, which are the early Dutch settlers, and veld, which is a relatively dry, grassy terrain common to the plains. Now to get ready for my own speak. I give you Under a Primitive Moon. The night call of the animals and the song of nature gave their collaboration in presenting an air of indescribable allure to the setting of the African sun. A blazing blend of red and yellow lit up the sky above the wide stretch of open veld, upon which Daka Ikwaga walked once again in the direction of the waterhole, or Sea of Meditation, as he had christened it. He walked with a crippled leg and used a knopkiri in case the pain became more of a burden than his leg could stand to bear. As he walked this eve, he cast a long, limping shadow and leaned heavily to the right, relying much upon his wooden aid. It was an hour ago since he had left the kraal to indulge in his one-mile journey across the veld. As he arrived by the sea, he felt exhausted. Daka was now an old man, and it seemed his beloved waterhole became a more strenuous journey each time he pursued it. He had lived to experience 2 entire generations and had had many wives and sons and daughters. 42 wives and 97 children. For reasons totally foreign to explanation, he suddenly found himself thinking of the many cattle it had been accustomed to trade for his wives. He concluded these thoughts in reassuring himself that the price was justified for all, except a few which had deserted him. The last rays of the evening sun touched his aged black skin, in golden reflections, as he sat cross-legged upon a bank of hardened clay, in observance of several wildebeest and zebras as they quenched their thirsts. A subtle wind whispered across the veldt, persuading the tall blades of grass to bow gently in their greetings. There was a solemn intrigue and mystery in this eve for Iquaga, as he sat in eager anticipation for the dark of night. It was in this night that he was to hold counsel with the spirits of Drakan and Jala. As he sat gazing up at the sky, he noticed seven stars evenly spaced apart, and following one another in a perfect horizontal row. He assumed this to be a message of the gods, yet understood nothing of its significance. The wildebeest and zebras had parted from the water and were now replaced by several chattering monkeys. The sky had surrendered itself to only a few clouded streaks of the parting sun, and the night sang softly of its coming. Daka used the Knopkiri to stand and looked far across the veldt to ascertain himself of any carnivorous prowlers. He then collected several twigs and brush to build a fire. Once aflame, he gave his thoughts to the former philosophers and leaders of his peoples, Drakan and Jala. Both had been slain in battle against the Fuhrtrekkers during their ruling. It had been during the leadership of Jala that the Sea of Meditation was chosen and anointed the sacred ground for only the leaders and wise men of the tribe to hold counsel, or purely for purposes of meditation. And sacred it was, for the spirits of the dead held communication there. Any of lesser authority bidding intrusion were to behold the curse of being outcast from the tribe, and thereupon hunted and killed. Iquaga was riddled and confused, for he knew not how the communication of this eve was to be performed. During the leadership of Jala, yet unlike Drakan, it had been custom to sacrifice a member of the tribe in order that the spirit may possess the flesh as an instrument of its communication. These sacrificial gatherings often resulted in the most horrid of events. In this moment, Daka's memory returned one particular night of such an occurrence. Many of the tribesmen would have volunteered their lives for such a sacrifice, as it was thought to be a most worthy cause and an honorable death. Though Mana had long preached its unworthiness and most influentially expressed his disbelief amongst his peoples, Jala had found this to be a threat to his leadership and therefore commanded Mana be the chosen sacrifice. This revolutionary of peace was thereupon seized and forcefully taken to the sacred grounds. He had battled violently against his captors and shouted shame upon his followers who aided him not. His desperate efforts to regain his freedom resulted in a total distortion of his facial structure. His left eye had been torn from its socket by a sharp rock which a warrior had used against him. As three held him fast, the fourth struck the rock repeatedly into his face, tearing his lips in such a manner that his cracked teeth and torn gum were revealed directly beneath the nostrils. His nose had been spared in splintered fragments, and his jaw hung loose and broken. Blood rushed furiously from every tear. His panic-filled struggle continued, and the most gruesome sounds emanated from within him, until the blade sank deep into his trembling heart. In nightmarish a sequence, the communication was then performed with his punctured, torn, and bleeding flesh. Daka had witnessed these events and shuddered at their recollection. The communication of that night was held with the slain Drakan and concerned procedures in battle against the Fuhrtrekkers. Jala fell to the mercy of a rifle bullet in the battle that followed. And Daka, the witch doctor, philosopher, and wise man, who had always reserved himself, was elected new leader of these native peoples. Due to the dreaded memory, he outruled all human sacrifice and brought wise teachings and philosophies of love to his people. And he spoke well of the revolution of Mana. Darker ascended from the depths of his thoughts and memories and once again became conscious of his surroundings. He saw that the moon had risen from his slumber and cast his light in silver reflections upon the still water. The fire burned well and yielded a generous light to the eyes of Iquaga as he scanned the area around himself for any movement or sign of their arrival. He saw naught and gradually resumed himself to his patient wait. As he sat in silent meditations, he heard a rustling sound from behind and moved closer to the fire. He had not yet cast a glance backward as he suddenly felt a warm, panting breath upon his naked back. The effect sent a shiver down his spine and he froze in his poise. As swift and unanticipated as lightning marks a somber sky, he retrieved a burning branch from the flames and turned, holding it before him, to face the mysterious presence. To his entire bafflement and shock, he found himself staring into the mocking gray eyes of an intimidating cheetah. Holding the burning branch to its face, he bent low to reach for his knopkiri. Once in his grip, he stretched back to enable a full swing and strong force against the head of the beast. It was in that moment that he heard what he could not conceive. The carnivore spoke. Indeed, a voice came from within the beast and spoke in a native tongue, thus saying, "Iquaga, cease! It is I, Drekan. I have come to hold counsel with you and must warn you that the Xawanga tribe has declared war against your people and will attack in the young hours of the morning. Unless you warn your people of their coming, they shall fall to the spears of the enemy while asleep." And the surprised Darker spoke. "I had long suspected this, yet not for the morrow. The gods be with me. I must warn my people, for they know of nothing and expect only the sunrise and my return." Darker looked about, noticing no sign of Jala, and asked, "What form has Jala chosen for the communication of this night?" The mouth of the cheetah opened, revealing strong canine teeth and a healthy jawbone. As the inhabiting spirit of Drekan spoke once more, in a voice of ages, "The spirit of Jala was condemned to the eternal fires, to exist no longer among creation." Darker felt no surprise as he heard of the condemnation of Jala, for he felt if justice was not meted out in the arena of life, it would indeed be done so within the chambers of the justice of the ruling gods. He looked deeply into the eyes of this carnivorous beast of prey and observed as the spirit strained it once again to speak. "Darker, you must look above and observe the seven stars. Note also that the moon follows directly behind them. It shall be when the moon passes over the seventh star that the cheetah will be relieved of my spirit and return to its natural instincts. You must therefore crush the skull of the beast, or it will destroy you. This will be my last communication, for I have been chosen to dwell once again amongst the living. I shall be returned as a child at birth. You will know of my coming, for I shall come as the son of the leader. The moon is now over the fifth star. You must prepare to destroy the beast and go back amongst your people to warn them of the Xawangas. Lead also your wife Letanga to safety, for she is the chosen flesh of my conception." The voice of Drekan ceased as the moon hid the seventh star. Instantly, Darker struck a fierce blow against the head of the carnivorous beast of prey, using his knopkiri, and the beast sank like death upon the ground. Somewhat disillusioned, he began his return to the kraal. He had to give warning and prepare his people for battle. Already a strategic plan seeped into his consciousness as he hurriedly made his way across the veldt. It was ere he had walked far from the sacred grounds that he heard an agonized growl from behind. He thought immediately of the cheetah which he had left for dead. Swiftly he turned to face his adversary, yet saw none. There appeared no sign of any existence behind him.
In sheer disarray, he turned to resume his walk. Ere he was fully able to conceive the next moments, he felt an excruciatingly painful tear across his chest. He fell weakened to the earth, and in his bafflement and horror, recognized the beast. It was not dead. Though it must have been in a frenzy of pain, for the side of its head, which had been struck by the Knopkiri, lay raw in its exposure. Ikwaga fumbled about blindly in an effort to regain his wooden aid, which he had lost in the fall. He had to defeat the beast and warn his people, or he felt their slaughter would haunt his soul forever. Drakan had warned him to destroy the beast, yet he had failed in his anxiety, and was now being dealt the penalty of his neglect. The carnivore tore once again into his naked being and, with one forceful blow of its monstrous claws, painfully parted the flesh from his battle-scarred stomach and exposed his ribcage in a most gruesome revelation. With his last strength, he released a yell that echoed far into the kraal and then surrendered himself to the savagery of the beast. Three warriors awoke at the sound of the piercing cry and rushed from their huts across the fell to the aid of Ikwaga. As they arrived, they saw naught but the scattered flesh of their leader, and then laid eyes upon the beast that lingered there. The warriors raised their spears, and then in mutual astonishment observed, as the carnivore spoke, "Cease, for it is I, Ikwaga, you must be warned!" With sudden effect, a warrior raised his voice and thereby awakened the others from their stupendous fixation. "It is an evil. Slay the beast," the warrior commanded, and the cheetah fell victim to their piercing spears. Once dead, the three warriors retrieved their spears and walked back in the direction of the kraal as the African sky cast its early morning light across the veldt. This has been Claudio Speakeasy and Radio Theatre on behalf of Bob Crowley, Audrey Layden, Alan R. Hall, Ira David Wood, Blake Tedder. I thank you all for tuning in. Until next time, cheers.